Last week, the first in-person civil jury trial was held in Cook County. All trials have kind of been on hold during COVID, those that are jury, that is. And a personal injury lawsuit resulted in a whopping $43 million verdict for a woman in this case. And we're going to talk a little bit about personal injury cases and how does a jury award that much money? Is this unusual? Is it too much or too little? How do juries decide and how do lawyers present the evidence? And with us to talk about this issue and malpractice is one of Chicago's finest personal injury attorneys, Tom Paris, who for 30 years has helped individuals and businesses in all types of litigation matters, including personal injury and malpractice. Welcome to the show, Tom. How are you?
Well, afternoon, Karen. Good to be with you today.
Sure. So let's talk just about this case. And again, we don't know all the facts. We weren't sitting in the jury room there. But $43 million sounds like a lot of money. But knowing how these kind of cases work, tell us what could have happened in this case and what the facts might have been that would require this kind of a verdict.
Well, as I understand the basics, there was a trucking case that happened out on the expressway. The trucking company admitted liability in the matter. I believe it was a rear-end crash. And the plaintiff was a nurse who ended up as a quadriplegic. So $43 million does sound like a lot of money to most people. But if you're a quadriplegic and you used to enjoy nursing, I don't think you'd make the trade-off. So the jury heard all of the evidence, and no doubt the trucking company had very good lawyers defending them. It wasn't like it was someone who didn't answer the complaint and come in and defend the case. It was heavily defended.
So in a case like this, what kinds of evidence does the jury get to consider in coming up with that dollar amount?
In a larger case like this, first you would have the plaintiff's doctors testify at length as to what they treated her for, what her life was going to be like in the future. You'd bring in friends and family, perhaps co-workers of the witness, and have them talk about the person that they knew and loved and how she is not what she was. And then a big part of the case as well is what we would call a life care planner. Obviously, there's a great deal of medical attention that some people need, and particularly when you're a quadriplegic and need the help of others to get by. And so you would hire a firm that analyzes all the medical care that one would need for the rest of their life, doctor's visits, wheelchairs, medications, you know, just everything. And oftentimes these verdicts are as much about future medical and past medical. I'm sure that the past medical in this case was, I'm sure, millions to arrive at a verdict like that. So those are the basic elements that a jury is going to consider and a lawyer is going to present in a case like this.
You know, I hear people who maybe aren't in the law and just say, like, oh, who deserves $43 million? I mean, I know she was badly hurt, but, you know, did these plaintiffs' lawyers just, like, do something crazy and convince them? I mean, do jurors do things that are outrageous, in your opinion? I mean, you've tried hundreds of these cases. You know, do jurors make the mistake here a lot?
Well, I've lost and won cases. I've tried cases before judges, too. And each case is unique, and each person is unique. You know, again, most people would not trade any sum of money to be a quadriplegic and or severely injured so that they no longer could return to their own life. But I guess I would say, in terms of the argument that there's crazy jurors out there, we hear that all the time when we're picking juries, and people talk about the McDonald's verdict. But the defendant is generally well insured, certainly a trucking company or a place like McDonald's. They don't skimp on hiring good lawyers either. And so the defense gets to cross-examine doctors, experts that come in and say, well, I think she needs a van that's equipped for getting around, and that would cost, whatever, $100,000. No doubt the defense has an expert who, if they wanted to, could come in and say, no, we could buy that van for $50,000, or that van will last 5 years and not 10 years, or whatever. So these cases at that level, as you can imagine, are heavily defended with excellent lawyers and excellent experts. And the common sense of the jury is what calls the day. And if you think about that, that's not such a bad system. I mean, most people would rather have a jury of their peers thinking about and evaluating a case rather than just, say, a single judge. Although that can be useful as well, to having a single judge. But I think most people getting the flavor of the community would have a juror, like to have a jury.
And I, you know, I've always said that, you know, the collective wisdom of 12 people who you don't know is generally a good decision. And again, you have outliers, you have decisions that you shake your head and you say, how could it be one way or the other? But I think jurors do a very good job. I think they're very diligent. I think they take their job extremely seriously. I think they try to be fair. And, you know, when I see a verdict like this, I think she probably had a lot of damages and she probably was a sympathetic woman. And, you know, no family should have to deal with this. If, you know, if someone was at fault, our system says that everything that relates to that fault, that negligent act, is compensable. And that's just the way our system is. If we don't like it, there are other countries that don't have that system. But I think that's a fair system. And that's, of course, why we have insurance. Right. I mean,
I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, some of the alternatives are, as I said, have a judge do it or just write it down in a book. You know, workers' comp cases are much more formalized and how much you make and what a body part is worth. Most people don't want to be lowered to that in a personal injury case. A defendant shouldn't be. Well, think about the alternative for a defendant. Would you rather be criminally prosecuted or would you rather have your mistake adjudicated by your peers and you hire or your insurance company, a good lawyer, to defend you? I don't think most people want to be in front of a regulatory or a criminal body for a negligent mistake. So those who would do away with the jury system generally don't think very far down the road about what the alternatives are. And think about the alternative of not having any system.
Right. That vigilante justice. We're talking to Tom Paris, and we're going to take a break here. If you have questions about personal injury cases, medical malpractice cases, anything having to do with these types of things, or any other question, I'll be taking your calls here on the Karen Conti Show, 312-981-7200. Back in a minute. Do you have questions about personal injury actions, car accidents? You have any questions about medical malpractice? I get a lot of these calls and a lot of these questions at my office when the listeners call in, and I'm very good at referring people to experts to make the decisions about whether or not there's a case. But right now we're talking to Tom Paris, who is a personal injury attorney, among other things, and he handles these types of cases. Tom, thank you for joining me. Let's talk just briefly, just bottom line bullet points here on the issue of car accidents. And we've all either been in one or we might be in one, hopefully nothing too serious, but let's talk about both sides of it. When you're in a car accident and you think the other party was at fault, what are some of the bullet point things that you should do and things that you should not do?
Well, first, if you're injured, before you even think about lawyers and stuff, I think you need to think about doctors who can treat your injury. And that's ultimately what the lawyers use to evaluate, and an insurance company, and ultimately jurors evaluate what kind of injury there is, who's better at talking about that than a doctor. Doctors make lots of notes and records, and presumably those have some accuracy as to what was going on. So see a good doctor, preferably a doctor that you already know, or, you know. And then you should think about talking to a lawyer about your case. The insurance company might be quick to give you a call. My experience that they generally minimize what is going on and when they make notes about what the injured party told them.
I mean, it's real common for them to call and say, how are you feeling today? And the person says, oh, I'm great. You know, take note. You know, I'm exaggerating just a little bit. But I mean, what you say to an insurance adjuster will be used against you. There's no question. So I'm sure, Tom, you tell people who are in a car accident, you know, before you start talking to anybody, make sure you're treated and don't be talking to the insurance adjuster because That may not be the best route to go.
They they go through a lot of training, and they know how to ask you questions that result in an answer that they want. I mean, you're feeling better today than yesterday? Well, what does that mean? I mean, really, yesterday you felt like you got hit by a truck. Today you're a little better than that. But what they put in the notes often enough is feeling good and maybe feeling better than yesterday. So absolutely. And that's their training. It's even more so beyond car crashes and a simple, not so simple slip and fall. They are well trained to ask you questions about liability. Well, did you, see the substance that you slipped on, or in a car crash, did you hear the honk of the horn? Did you, see the light? And they want to commit you to a recording that later on, perhaps when you're not feeling well, you're making this recorded statement, perhaps you're on some pain medications, perhaps you're whatever, but it's not a good idea. No, you should be talking to your lawyer and not a tape recorder that an insurance adjuster has running.
And there's no hurry to resolve things because you have to get all your treatment done before you even think about settling or hiring a lawyer and doing all those things. We're taking some calls here, 312-981-7200. Tom, would you like to take a call? We've got Peter in Grays Lake. Hi, Peter. Welcome to WGN. Hi. You have a question for Tom and for me?
Yeah, I hurt myself about 20 years ago. I broke both my shoulders, and last year I broke my neck.
Oh my goodness!
With a fall, and Medicare. I went on Medicare, and I had to get a new doctor. So I went to this doctor, and he said, "Well, he says, are you here trying to get hydrocortisone?" And I says, "I just want to get better." Well, what happened was I went to another doctor to get another opinion, and the second doctor told me, he goes, we all talk to each other. He says, apparently you've seen another doctor. And I says, yeah. I said, I'm trying to get a second opinion. Well, they all thought it was my neck, and I was complaining about my shoulders. They said, finally, I told the doctor, I says, I don't want to see you anymore. I says, you're not doing me, all you're doing is chastising me. And what he did was he sent me to a specialist. They took x-rays of my shoulders, and they says, man, they're totally crushed. He goes, there's nothing we can do with it. He says, I wouldn't touch your shoulders.
Okay, hold on, Peter. Wait, hold on.
They
sent me to all these
different doctors.
Hold on, Peter.
And then they blacklisted me.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to put you on hold. All right. So I'm not sure where we're going with this, but I hear about this a lot, Tom, where a doctor refuses to see a patient, or maybe an entire medical practice says, we're not going to treat you anymore. We're not going to see you anymore. What is your experience with that? Is that something that they can do?
Well, there is a registry of the opioids these days, and I think that some of them are, and I don't have any idea whether Peter falls within to this, but that might be what he was referring to when they said us doctors talk. I think most doctors are pretty busy and wouldn't talk to another doctor outside of their practice group, just, at a cocktail party about someone they saw that day. So I'm not sure how that communication took place, and doctors take HIPAA pretty seriously. But, I don't know, if you've had an injury for 20 years, presumably that's been treated over time. So it's difficult to talk about that specifically.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly what he was getting at. And when you call in, we got to get to the point of it, because a lot of times you have a complaint and you have years of treatment or years of something, but I need the question so we can answer it. Because if you go on and on about all of this, it's just hard to kind of get an answer. And I'm trying to get you some help or get him, at least a suggestion to move in the right direction. It sounded to me like he was angry that he was blacklisted, and it wasn't so much a mistreatment or malpractice or failure to diagnose as much as it was that his doctor wasn't seeing seeing him. And in my experience, I don't think you can't sue a doctor for refusing service or refusing treatment.
No,
it's not something that's worth pursuing. It makes you angry, perhaps, but it's nothing that is compensable or something that a lawyer would take on in that regard. Let's talk a little bit, Tom, while some other callers are calling in, about medical malpractice. And these cases are very difficult, and a lot of and you do these kinds of cases, but tell us what needs to happen before there's a lawsuit for medical malpractice, and then I want to talk about how to avoid medical malpractice.
Yeah, let me talk broadly about medical malpractice cases and say that I'm going to give you some surprising statistics. As you can imagine, they're very expensive cases to pursue. They're very highly dependent on each side bringing in doctors and experts to talk about whether someone was injured in this fashion or not, and whether the doctor should have caught that. Frankly, it shocks most people when I tell them this, but two-thirds of cases, even in Cook County, are lost at trial in a medical malpractice setting. So if you're suing a hospital or a doctor and you go to trial, a plaintiff has about a third chance of winning. So most people would think by what they hear and read that, you know, you just show up and get the check. That's pretty far from. Now, let me talk about what I think most medical malpractice cases involve. And they do. They involve some communication failure more often than not. Hospitals, in particular, you have a 24/7 operation that relies upon very highly skilled people and people at lower skill levels and all in between. They all have to communicate with each other effectively. The patient has to communicate effectively, and the patient isn't a highly skilled doctor who went to medical school, and so some of that communication even can be lacking with the plaintiff or the patient. So it's useful to have what I often call a patient advocate, a loved one who can be a second set of ears, can be a second mouth to talk about what the problems are. And if I'm correct, and I'm telling you I am, the communication lies at the heart of a lot of medical malpractice cases, and perhaps a lot of errors generally outside of the medical profession. Having somebody there beside you helps. And if you have someone in your life who can fulfill that role, bring them with.
Well, and you know, and it's sometimes the squeaky the wheel gets the grease. And when you're not feeling well and you're feeling helpless and in pain or whatever it is, when you've got that advocate there asking the right questions, taking the right notes, making the demands to say, you know, she needs this medicine or she needs something, she's really in pain, and can you explain this again? I don't understand it. What are my options? And can you explain it again? You know, those are the people who you want beside you because you know, the person who's sick is not always the best person to be taking in that information.
During the pandemic, a lot of people who never graduated high school became infectious disease experts all of a sudden, and along with their constitutional law degrees. So, you know, there's a lot of information that can be at a very high level that's communicated with doctors, and so there's no shame in bringing somebody with you. They don't have to have a medical degree. You don't have to bring a nurse or a doctor with you, just somebody you trust to listen. Maybe write down the questions that you have ahead of time. Maybe write down some of your symptoms. Bring something in with you, because I think your doctor would appreciate that. And if he or she doesn't, it might be time to find another doctor who wants to listen to you a little bit more.
We're talking to Tom Paris. Tom, I'm going to keep you on if that's okay, and I'm going to get to Mary. Mary's got an interesting question on the other side of the news. But Tom, quickly, how do people contact you? Why don't you give a phone number, and I'll give your email out in a minute.
Sure. My phone at the office is 312-759-1600, 1600.
Stay tuned for the Karen Conti Show and give us a call here if you have a question, 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. Well, Welcome back to the Karen County Show. I'm here talking to Tom Paris, who's a personal injury lawyer, among other things, here in Chicago. And we're talking about medical malpractice right now. If you have a question for Tom or for me about any legal question, give us a call here at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Tom, you ready to go here?
I'm ready.
All right, Mary, let's go to your call. Mary in Chicago, welcome to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about your issue?
Oh, hi. I'll try and be brief. About 5 years ago, I was at my doctor's office and told them about a symptom I noticed I had for at least a year. It wasn't looked into. It wasn't talked about. It was kind of just set aside. And on top of that, I never, ever, I can't emphasize it enough, I never see the doctor. I always see the nurse practitioner, and that's who missed the cancer.
Mary, it did
end up in cancer.
Okay, Mary, let me just ask you a question, then Tom can take it over. What was the complaint that you had that you told them about? Oh, is Mary gone? Okay, Mary's going to have to call back.
Karen, let me say,
go ahead.
There are limitation periods for everything from a written contract that is breached to a car crash or a medical malpractice case. In terms of personal injury aspects, whether it's a car crash or a doctor or whatever, it's generally 2 years. Now, that 2 years can be extended if you didn't know what was, that there was a problem, but you have to have some workarounds. So if there is a legal problem that you have, you need to see a lawyer because the clock is ticking. Now, it's a 2-year clock, so that's generally plenty of time, but 5 years is, 2.5 times what the law allows. And so there is some difficulty with any problem. Now, someone leaves a sponge in you, the classic, and you didn't know about it, and you have some more surgery a few years later because you've been having some indigestion and they find the sponge. Well, you might well still have a case because you didn't know until they did that second surgery and took the sponge out.
But, and you couldn't have known. I mean, how would you know? So the law provides some, like you said, some workarounds because it's 2 years. But again, when anyone has an issue, whether it's a car accident or whatever, I always say, if you're even at all thinking about hiring a lawyer, do it sooner rather than later, because you don't want to mess around with insurance companies talking to you. And sometimes they talk you in past the 2-year statute of limitations, not to ascribe any bad motives.
That has happened many times in the subject of many court cases alone, frankly.
Yeah.
So, get medical care, but when you're in a position to talk to somebody, call a lawyer. Most lawyers will take your call. They might have a paralegal or somebody first getting out some, learning about some facts and learn some basics. But they will generally not charge for that first call. And so if you think there's something wrong, call a lawyer, see if he or she can identify the problem legally.
And it's, again, it's a free call. So why not do it? And even if, and Tom, I'm sure you do this a lot. I know that you're a very ethical lawyer. I refer clients to you. I know some of your clients. And I know that, sometimes people decide they don't want to bring the suit for one reason or another, or they want to settle with not, going to trial, or they want to, maybe not pursue it as actively and as aggressively as a lawyer. And, that's okay. But I think at least to know. And I think that if you have a loved one who died or has a problem, don't you want to know? Was it something the doctor did? Or was it just something that would have happened anyway? And I think it puts people's mind to rest a little bit to talk to a lawyer and have that lawyer make that assessment. Do you agree with me on that?
I totally agree. And then there's the practical aspect of gathering the evidence. In a medical malpractice case, these are complicated cases that, I have listened to clients and thought, well, that's a great case. And I gather the medical records, which takes time. Sometimes it takes a lot of time. And I send it to a doctor to take a look at, which is required. I mean, I can't just say, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great case. I didn't go to medical school, but I have the internet, you know, and I'll go ahead and file that suit. That's not allowed with doctors. You have to have another doctor who knows the subject area sign a certificate of merit and explain why he or she thinks there's a problem here. That takes time. And if you are calling my office, you know, even just a few months before the statute of limitations, that period of time runs, I might not even want to go any further because I don't want to cause you malpractice myself. And I know it's going to take time to get those records and have a doctor review it. And so, and I'd also say this, many, many, many cases resolve without filing suit. And so some people just, the idea of a lawsuit is distasteful to them. That's fine. Get to a lawyer, as I said, first deal with the medical issues that are going on, but get to a lawyer because that case needs to be investigated. Maybe someone, you know, pictures need to be taken, statements need to be had, medical records have to be evaluated. You might be able to avoid a lawsuit. Lots of cases don't require a lawsuit and they're resolved prior to a lawsuit, but the same analysis goes on in or outside of a lawsuit.
We're here with Tom Paris talking about personal injury cases, medical malpractice, car accidents, and the slip and falls and the variety of personal injury cases. And we're taking your call here, 312-981-7200. We've got Randall in Hyde Park. Hi, Randall. Welcome to WGN. What's your question for Tom?
I'm just curious. I didn't try to get a lawyer when the dentist took out my whole bridge in order to remove one tooth. I tried to fight this myself, thinking I would get the dental office to recover what they'd done. I couldn't find a lawyer that would even take my case.
So, Tom, why don't you follow up with it?
Well, Randall, thanks for calling. Dental cases do present a challenge. They're just like medical cases in terms of very highly dependent on another doctor, or in this instance, another dentist, testifying and signing off on that case. And so most dental cases are, there's less damages than, somebody dies or, you know, the subject of many other medical cases. And so now you're saddled with a lot of the expenses, even though the recovery and a lot of the work in terms of a lawyer working them up. So I don't know the specific facts there, but I can tell you from reading the jury verdict reporter and settlement reporter in Cook County that, dental malpractice cases are far less frequent. I don't believe that's because there's less malpractice in that area. I just know that it's more expensive relative to the value to pursue. And that may sound harsh, and I'm sorry if it does, but it is the reality of the system that we have. There's a lot of work for the lawyer and a lot of expenses. And if he or she is going to do all that work and at the end of the day you have very little afterwards, all you're going to be is ticked off at your lawyer as well as your dentist, frankly.
And Randall, just, you know, put it another way, and this is sometimes how I say it, it could be that you were wronged. It could be that the dentist did absolutely the wrong thing, and you are right, he was wrong. But the amount of loss and amount of money at stake is not enough for a lawyer to take the case on a contingent basis, meaning you don't pay the lawyer until there's a recovery. And so it's a business decision for the lawyer. And again, as Tom said, it sounds harsh, like, well, why didn't you take my case? There's not enough money at the end of the rainbow to justify the hundreds of hours and the thousands of dollars I may have to put into it, if that makes
sense. Tens of thousands. By the way, that's opinion, Karen, is shared by the Harvard Medical School as well. They think there's a lot more medical malpractice that happens than there are medical malpractice lawsuits, and many other think tanks have confirmed that.
And the reason that we don't see them is because lawyers can't afford to take them, and plaintiffs, of course, can't pay the lawyer by the hour. But, Randall, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. And we'll come back. We've got some more calls here. 312-981-7200 if you have a question about medical malpractice, car accidents, slip and fall, workers' compensation, or anything relating to that. We'll be here on WGN.
We'll be right back.
We're here in the last lap of the Karen Conti Indianapolis 500. Did everyone listen to that on the radio? It was nice. We WGN had the Kentucky Derby and the Indianapolis 500. It's really great. Although listening to it kind of is interesting, isn't it? To be a radio announcer of a car race. It's a real special niche there. Anyway, give us a call here. We're talking to Tom Paris, who's a personal injury lawyer, 312-981-7200. If you want to contact him, I'm going to give you his information at the end of the show. And of course, if you have any legal questions at all, need a referral to somebody, you can always contact me at 312-332-7800, or better yet, send me an email, and I have a new form, so you can fill it out, basically give the facts of the case, when it happened, where you are, what you're looking for, and that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, wgn@askkarenconti.com. Okay, Tom, here we go. We have Harry in Chicago who's got a medical malpractice question. Hi, Harry. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great topic. Very interesting because it hits home. I was just curious to get the counselor's opinion. A number of years ago, I was damaged quite substantially by a LASIK procedure on my eyes, which is not uncommon in that field. And I basically wound up, never received informed consent, and I wound up flying all over the country seeing other surgeons. And basically what I found out from talking to doctors and then talking to attorneys, they said, well, the problem is getting, even if you've been damaged, as you have, trying to find a surgeon to testify against another surgeon in the same field is almost impossible. And that is exactly what I found out. And I was actually told by one doctor, he said, the Hippocratic Oath about first do no harm. And he said, actually, with surgeons and doctors, it's first do no harm to another doctor. and I was pretty aghast. And,
Harry, before I'm going to turn it over to Tom, I'm going to ask you a question. So you went in for LASIK surgery, and what happened? Did something go wrong with the operation?
It's an imperfect procedure, and there's so many problems with it. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of side effects.
Okay, and you were suffering those side effects.
Focusing, glare, halos, loss of night vision, loss of depth perception. There's a lot of retinal detachment. There's a whole bunch of stuff that is associated with LASIK, they found out.
Tom,
and so
let's see if Tom can weigh in a little bit on these kinds of cases.
Well, sure.
Harry, what you were told by a doctor is true in my view, that most doctors will not testify against another doctor in their same area. That is, if I, was looking at your case, frankly, I mean, I might ask a local doctor if I knew one in that area, and I, obviously do know some doctors around town, but it's rare that you would hire an expert as a plaintiff who's in the same town. There's an ophthalmologist in San Francisco that I have used successfully in cases. And it is what it is. I'm not going to change it. I can tell you this, in a legal malpractice case, it's almost the exact opposite. I have served as an expert and sued lawyers. I probably wouldn't serve as an expert for a California case because there's a lot of things that are different out there. But your experience is my experience as well. You're not going to find an expert in that field locally. Defendants, no problem. The defense doctor is almost always going to hire somebody within town, and they'll be glad to testify.
And Harry, how are you doing? Are you doing okay with your eyesight now?
No, it's been 20 years of a struggle. That it kind of blew up. The person who approved it by the FDA, the industry had withheld all the negative information. He went back to the FDA and asked that they remove LASIK, and they wouldn't do it. And so There's a site actually on Facebook. It's called LASIK Complications for anybody whose eyes have been ruined or damaged. A lot of lives, and there have been a number of suicides related to LASIK.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
But
go ahead.
I really appreciate the show. I appreciate you having the topic on, and the gentleman counselor is absolutely correct, and I understand it, and it's a tough situation for patients, particularly when they feel like there's nowhere to go.
Yeah,
you know, they've been damaged, and there's just nowhere to go.
I appreciate the call, Harry. Really, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck to you. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure. And, you know, Tom, I'm sure you tell people this all the time. Sometimes, and this is in every kind of case, not just personal injury cases, but when you're wronged, I had a gentleman the other day, he was wronged in a case, actually it was a contractor who basically, you know, took his money, didn't do anything, and it was worth about $1,200. And I told him, you know, lawyers charge $300-$500 an hour, and so it makes no sense to hire a lawyer. And he kept arguing with me saying, but I want to get my money back. And I said, yes, you should get your money back. This guy completely defrauded you, but you're going to either have to do it yourself or you're going to have to walk away, because why would you pay a lawyer $20,000 to get $1,200? And
yeah,
it's unfortunate.
I agree, Karen, and I've given similar advice, and my tagline for that is, it's going to be more expensive to hire me than the tradesmen to fix that problem. And at the end of the day, we may win this case, but my attorney's fees are not going to be recoverable as part of that case. You know, we may lose that case. I don't, you know, depends on the facts and depends on a lot of things and the law, but it's almost always cheaper to hire a tradesman to fix it. Now, there's exceptions, and I don't want to say that you shouldn't pursue it, but yes, and in terms of a pro bono lawyer at a legal clinic to try to sort that out, it's not likely that most clinics are going to handle a situation like that, though some might, you know, the law schools or something, I'm not sure.
Well, it's hard. It is hard to find. People think there's pro bono lawyers for every single case, whether it's a divorce or what have you, and there just aren't. And as, you know, someone said, I don't even know who, I quote it so often, I don't even remember who said it originally, which is, the people who need legal help the most can afford it the least. And that is very, very true. And it's very unfortunate that we have that situation. Let's see if we can take one more call, but we're going to have to make this fast. Carol in Chicago, you have a question for us. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Karen. If you tell somebody you have a no trespassing sign on your property and someone comes on your property to do work on their home and they fall and injure themselves, are you as liable for any personal injury to them? I'm not a nasty person. It has to do with the man's age and his physical ability to climb on a ladder.
Okay, Carol, I'm sorry. Was this the person that you called on the property to fix
something? No, my next-door neighbor.
And was on your property?
Yeah, he comes on my. I told him, I don't want you on my property. I have a no trespass.
Okay.
Capable to be. The minute he puts his foot on a ladder, he's not. He's going to fall off.
Okay.
He was
Tom,
in a bad accident ago, and he's not physically able to climb up a ladder. But yet he does it. In his mind, he still thinks he's 35 when he's 75.
Okay. Tom, do you want to address?
Yeah, sure. The rule on trespassing and getting injured, an injured trespasser, is that the landowner has a duty to refrain from willful and wanton misconduct. Think about a youngster trespassing on railroad property and getting injured. Not an uncommon situation. Generally speaking, though, there's different exceptions. The you know, the youngster is trespassing and whatever, he loses his finger or his hand or his arm by the train. The duty is to refrain from willful and wanton conduct. That's what's much different than just negligence. So that same rule applies in your case, that you have to refrain. You can't intentionally put a hole for the guy to fall into. You know, that would be willful and wanton misconduct, but you don't have to put some pavers out for the guy and have a nice smooth area for him to walk across either.
So if he trespassed, unless you did something that was really willful, that you shouldn't be liable to. Now, does that mean that you won't get sued? That's the answer is no, because people can sue for whatever they want. And hopefully your homeowner's insurance or your renter's insurance would cover that. And that's one thing you should remember whenever you ever get sued or anyone threatens to sue you, whether it's a car accident or homeowners, a property issue, always look to your insurance because you never know what might be covered, whether, you know, it's a property issue or a trip and slip and fall or whatever it is. Give it to your insurance carrier, whether it's your umbrella policy or your homeowner's or your car, and hopefully they'll cover. And if they won't, they'll tell you why.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
All right,
thank you,
Carol.
Very much.
All right. Thank you so much, Carol. Tom, thank you for joining us. And let me have you give out your telephone number and your email address. And again, if people don't get it in time, they can always call me. And I give out my number quite a bit. But go ahead, Tom.
Sure. People can give me an email at tp@tomparislaw.com. So it's tp@tomparislaw.com. Call me at the office, 312-759-1600.
Tom, thank you so much for spending part of my Sunday with me here, and we'll see you at the office.
All right. Nice to be with you, Karen.
All right. Take care. Very interesting conversation, and I just wanted to say one final word of congratulations. 271 new attorneys were sworn in on Thursday via live video broadcast here in Chicago, and we have 271 new attorneys licensed in Illinois. Guess how many attorneys we have? We have 94,610 lawyers in the state of Illinois. Not everyone practices law, but that's a lot of lawyers, and good luck to you all, you new lawyers out there. Hopefully you'll all get jobs and pay off your student loans in a very quick period of time. Thank you for listening. Have a great week, and thank you for listening to The Karen Conti Show on the greatest radio station in Chicago, and that is WGN.